Good afternoon, and thanks for joining me as I host Reaching for the Gold. I hope that you will join me every other Tuesday afternoon at this time when the show is broadcast. My two guests today both have the same goal. They each want to help people get themselves together in the best sense of those words. But while Karen Beach writes a book designed to keep women on the right track, David Spiro does the same thing for the musicians he manages. Karen, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Harriet, for having me.
Now, Karen, you talk about your message is get it together, girl. What do you mean by that phrase? Everyone would have their own understanding. What do you mean by that?
Right, and it's a broad phrase, I know, get it together, girl. But the idea is that all of us have something we want to get together, be it organization, time management, or even a health issue or a relationship. So Get It Together, Girl is really a call to action designed to help people take the action they need to take to change their situation.
What would you summarize your message as being then? You would summarize it as being do what you need to do to reach your goal, or how would you summarize it?
Summarize it as start where you are and use what you have to get to what you want.
Okay, that sounds wonderful, but I definitely have a few questions with that.
Okay.
What if somebody comes to you and they say, I want to be in the Olympics. That's my goal. Karen, show me how I can organize myself and do what I need to do so I can be in the Olympics. How would you respond to something like that? We have a society where you turn on the TV, you turn on the internet, whatever it is you do, you see people who are doing these extreme things. You see people who are 6'3 and weigh 100 pounds. How do you respond to people when they say something like that? I want to be in the Olympics. I want to be a model. How would you respond? Or is that not something you get very often?
That really isn't something I get very often. I get people that are a little bit more grounded than that. But if I had someone coming to me that said they wanted to be in the Olympics, my first question would be, and, you know, are you an Olympian? Have you won certain events going up to that? Is that something that is attainable for you? So that would be my first question. I mean, you see people on American Idol every year that can't sing a lick. So maybe that might be the good goal, right goal for you, but maybe if your passion is playing this sport, maybe you can get enjoyment out of it and fulfillment out of it without going to the Olympics.
Do you say then, most people do not come to you with these unrealistic goals?
No.
Let's look at this a little bit and try to understand. What if somebody comes to you with goals, I'd like to work at blank, 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 and you think they might be able to do much more? How would you deal with that? How would you deal with their getting their expectations to maybe a little more admirable level or a different level? I won't say admirable, that's too judgmental, to a different level. How would you go about that?
Well, I probably wouldn't, because people want what they want for whatever reasons. And so as a person with a coaching background and not a psychological background, I don't want to delve into why you want what you want for yourself. But once they reach that goal, I might say, okay, now that you're there, now that you're comfortable where you are, would you consider taking another step? because everything that I do is to get people where they want to be, not necessarily mm-hmm. where I think they should be.
That's a very major distinction.
Very. It's a very major distinction. And when I talk about goal setting, I have a whole section called Stop Shitting on Yourself, because you don't meet goals that you think you should make or that someone else wants for you more than you want for yourself. So success is different for everyone. And so my job is to help you define what success means to you and then help you develop a roadmap to get you there.
Now, let's talk a bit about the books you've written. You say
sure.
you have written books, Get It Together, Girl. Tell us a little bit about them, how you
sure.
happen to do this, what they are.
Sure. I have three Get It Together, Girl books because when I have a background in training, but when I got my degree in life coaching, my certification, I realized that it was small things that kept people from doing what they wanted to do. So my series of books is designed to help people get those little things out of the way. So the first one is on home organization. And it seems like a very mundane topic. But if your home is organized, and let's say that you're not spending your mornings rushing and looking for things, then you're starting your day off in a more positive place than rushing and being harried. The second book is on time management techniques, because I have people telling me all the time that they don't have time. In fact, my first book on home organization breaks it down into 15-minute tasks over 28 days. So everyone has 15 minutes. But when I wrote the second one, I wrote it in response to a woman that said she didn't have 15 minutes. So I wrote a book with just different techniques to help you save little blocks of time. And little blocks of time can add up to larger blocks of time if you're just using it wisely. And then my third book is on goal setting, setting holistic, realistic, and comprehensive goals. The one I'm working on now is on saving money.
Now, when you talk about goal setting, when you talk about any of these things, can you think of an instance? Now, do you work directly with people who come to you and say, Karen, I need some help in getting myself together? Or you've written these books, or you do both, or how does that happen?
I do both. I work with people, and then I get a lot of great feedback from people who have used my book successfully.
Give me an instance. You say you have great feedback. Give me an example where you really think your methods were very, very successful and significantly help somebody?
I get a lot of feedback from Amazon.com. And on my goal setting book, I've got a great review from someone who was dealing with a lot of crisis in their life. And they said my book on goal setting really helped them to focus and focus their efforts and really make changes in their lives. So I would say that is huge. And the time-saving techniques, the home organization techniques, have really gone to help people save time and improve their environment. And I get a lot of feedback about mornings being easier, less stressful, because when you're a little bit of organization goes a long way to reducing your stress level and improving your outlook. So I've gotten that feedback as well from people who've applied these techniques.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Can you think of instances where you were, for lack of a better way to put it, very frustrated because you felt that you just were not getting through to somebody, and maybe it just wasn't a realistic thing to expect you could do. In other words, somebody could obviously do A, B, C, or D. They didn't think they could, or they wouldn't try, whatever it was. They were sabotaging, and it was obvious they were sabotaging, and you didn't feel you could do much about it.
That there's a lot of that out there, and when I coach people one-on-one, the first session is a free session, and it's designed to determine if I would be the right coach for you and also if you would be the right client for me. And so I don't take on clients who start with a defeatist attitude, because to me, either you know something's going to work and you're willing to try it, or you're going to keep putting guards up to keep you from even taking a step.
Mm-hmm.
And when I see people who every time you say something good, they say, yeah, but, or have you thought about this? Yeah, you know, however, I can't. If everything I say to you is met with that response, then you're not in a place where you're going to make any real changes.
Now, from my life experience, and I'd like to get some comment on this, I see an awful, awful lot of people who are fantastic, very brave, for lack of a better word, at survival. They do what they need to do to keep themselves going, get the bills paid, do what they have to do. They are so involved in that that it is hard for them to understand, hey, if I want to get out of this survival mode and get into a push-ahead mode, in other words, I want to start treading water and get to a good, firm stroke that will get me to the shore or wherever I want to go. Do you find much of that? People who are very, very determined but don't quite understand, hey, you got to go to plan B to not only allow you to survive but also to go ahead, and whose life may be, you know, they have two kids, they're a single parent, they have a rough job, who may be just so encompassed in this and so worn by this that it is hard for them to understand taking the next step. Do you encounter much of that?
Yes, and that's actually the type of person that Get It Together Girl is written for. People who are consumed so much with living life and getting by that they don't feel that they can get ahead. They don't have the time, they don't have the energy, they don't have the focus. And so a lot of what my books do is sort of clear out the muck so that you can get started, and that most of the time to get started, you don't need a lot of time. You need some time, you need some money, but more than anything, you need the desire. Because I'll give you a good example. I had a client who was studying for the bar, or trying to study for the bar. And she claimed she couldn't study because she couldn't find two-hour blocks of time in their day. Well, what adult can find two-hour blocks of time in their day? So I convinced her. I'm like, well, could you really get started if you only used an hour? And could you go into work maybe a half hour early and then stay at work that extra hour to get your studies done after everyone's gone home? And she was able to do that. But she was thinking in her mind, I have to have a two-hour block. I don't have a two-hour block. And because she didn't, she wasn't studying at all. So sometimes a lot of what I do is convince people to start small and not to discount small, because small over time can make a huge difference.
I'm sure it can. Now, going along this track and delving a bit deeper, as we know, there are millions and millions of people who are fantastic at doing what they need to do to survive, but maybe need a little push to get ahead. Now, don't these people sometimes find a resistance not in themselves, but possibly in those around them who say, hey, wait a minute, she wants to go and get blip blip degree or get whatever job or pass the bar or whatever. Hey, I'm blank, blank, blank. I'm nowhere near there. Hey, wait a minute. I don't want somebody outshining me. I'm going to say, hey, are you really sure you can do that? Do you find people find encountering much resistance in their environment instead of support?
Oh, definitely. And one of the things I say in my goal-setting book is that you need to have a team around you to help you meet that goal. And the people on that team might not be the people that should be on that team. You know, you might not have your closest friends and family members on that team, but you need to find people who will support you and who will encourage you and who will offer you help along the way. You know, maybe you have a friend that could babysit your kids on an evening when you need to go to class. Maybe you have another friend to offer emotional support when you have a hard class or you have a hurdle at school. Someone to help you find financial aid and go through it. And a lot of times, too, it might be convincing people in the household that what you're doing isn't going to have the impact they assume it will have on your life.
Mm-hmm.
But even without them, you need to find people that will have your back and support you. And it might be friends. It might not be family. But if you're really ready to go forward, I've found in my life that the help you need will be there.
Karen, what you're discussing is, it's very interesting. It really is. And a lot comes into my head when I hear you. You realize, I'm sure, you are asking people what may sound like a small leap may really be a pretty major step. Moving away from a certain mindset, a certain situation that cultivates and ingrains that mindset to something else, that's a major leap.
It's a major leap, and not everybody is ready to take it.
Oh, I wouldn't think so.
But for those, and my efforts are not about convincing people who aren't ready to be ready. It's working with people who are ready and who are going to do something.
What would be signs to you that somebody is ready? I come to you and I say, well, I've been doing the same job for, I'm going to say 10 years. I think I can do better, but that means going to college. I'm not sure I can do it. What would be signs that, yeah, you are ready? Not that, well, just give it a try. What would be signs you are seriously ready?
They have a vision. They have an idea. That they have something within them, and you can tell when you talk to somebody. Is that frustration, is that dissatisfaction at a level where you're going to be ready to make a change?
Well, there not only has to be dissatisfaction, but there has to be...
That's why I said a vision as well. And sometimes that dissatisfaction can be the fuel of that vision. But you kind of know where you want to go, what you want to do. You've thought about it, and maybe you've taken a few baby steps in that direction. But now you're not afraid. You're afraid that you can't go further. But you're willing to put in the effort. That's what it really comes down to. Are you willing to make a change? Are you willing to start at Tri-C and not Cleveland State?
Well, what you're saying again gets to the realistic. Sometimes when people say, I don't like what's going on, I'm going to do something. Woo, boy, that's when sometimes the unrealism comes in.
Yeah, and that's part of getting it together is being able to see, okay, I might not be able to go to John Carroll or Case Western. Maybe I can find what I need at Cleveland State. Or maybe even before I get to Cleveland State, I need to get those first couple of years through at Tri-C before I move on. You know, it's more economical, it's closer, I can get everything done. You have to be willing to put aside perfection.
I understand. Now, how did you happen to get into this line of work? How did that happen for you?
Well, number one, it's the way I've lived my life. Realizing that you don't have the luxury of time. People always think that there's going to be a tomorrow, but there's going to come a time when there's not tomorrow, and none of us know when that is. Had you asked my mother when I was 12 or 13, would she be around to see me graduate from high school, college, get married? That one still hasn't happened yet, but graduate from high school and college, she would have said yes, of course. She did not expect to spend the last year of her in half of her life suffering from complications of diabetes and losing her eyesight and having her kidneys fail and all of that. And so what that taught me is that none of us are guaranteed tomorrow. So we have to take action today, now. And that's pretty much the way I've lived my life. And I've spent the past 20 years in the field of training and development, and while I enjoyed it, I ended up getting my coaching certification because I wanted to train people on the thing that was most important to them, and that's themselves. Everybody's interested in doing better, being better, having something different. So that's how I got into this line of work, and when I started coaching clients, I realized that a lot of people were letting these little things get in their way. And if they got those things together, that it could make a difference in their lives.
Now, as you obviously know, we are entering a rough world. We are in a rough world where, because of computerization and many, many other things, more is expected of people than it ever previously was.
True.
Do you take that into account when you help people with their goals? In other words, if I want to be a nurse today, oh my goodness, that's a very different thing than wanting to be a nurse even 5 years ago. More is demanded in school, more is demanded on the job. I need to concern myself about advanced training, on the job training, many, many things. How do you take into account the fact that the ante is upped educationally, job-wise, every-wise?
Well, the ante is up, and whatever a person's goal is, be it nursing or going to law school or becoming a policeman, my goal is to let them realize everything that's involved. So as a coach, I never tell you what to do. I ask questions. Okay, so what kind of schooling would you need to take to do that nursing, get that nursing degree? How long would that take for you? What kind of grades would you need to get? And have them come to that realization. Now, after that, they might determine that medical billing is a better fit for them, or something else. But I'm asking them to get that information because they're the only ones that's going to be doing it. Therefore, they're the only people that can make a decision about whether that's the right thing for them. But my job is to make sure you're getting the information you need to make a good decision.
Now, how has the work you do changed? We talk about aging on this show. How has the work we do, you alluded to this before, but how has the work you do and your life experiences changed the way you look at aging? That's something most people don't even want to think about.
No, you don't. Yeah, people are frightened of that. People are frightened of a lot of things.
They are.
But, you know, when I think about getting older, you know, you talk about nursing having changed. Getting older has changed in this country. You know, when my grandfather retired, he had a great pension. He lived right on Superior, because I'm from Cleveland, and spent a whole lot of money every day on lottery tickets because he could. But he
Not
had
now.
Worked at a steel mill for 40, 50 years.
Not now.
You don't do that anymore. We live longer. So to me, and a lot of my older listeners and my older clients, they're at a point where they've paid their dues. They've done what needs to be done. Now they want to do something for them. What are they going to enjoy? What do they want to do? And then some of them come to the realization that they might not be ready to retire. So if they're going to keep working, how is that going to change? What is that going to look like? So they have a lot of the same issues that younger people have.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because they're thinking about transition and change, and how do I make that change? Now, the benefit that the older people have, my older listeners and clients, is they have the benefit of lifetime experience. So they don't have to go out there and make the same mistakes that the young people are making, because they pretty much already made them.
Mm-hmm.
And thankfully in an age before Facebook and social media. But I think older people kind of have a respect and an idea of what's involved in making a big change.
Mm-hmm. Now,
and they also, in some cases, have dug themselves in a really big rut. So they might have a ways to go if they're going to even be in a mindset to make a change.
Now, if somebody would like to reach you to have you work as a coach for them or in another capacity, how would they reach you?
They can just go to my website, getittogethergirlmedia.com. Getittogethergirlmedia.com. And there's a page on my site that describes my different coaching packages. Right from the first page, you could get my workbooks. And the good thing about my workbooks is everything in Get It Together Girl is designed to be affordable. So if you have a Kindle, you can get my books for $1.99. If you don't have a Kindle, each workbook, because they're very short, and you're going to work, that's why they're called workbooks, those are available for $6.99. So even with shipping, you can be out of the door for less than $10.
Wow. Karen, I'd like to thank you very much for being a guest on this show. I'm sure you gave my listeners a lot to think about, and thank you very much. I would like
thank
to remind
you,
my listeners that for more information about aging, go to Harriet Tramer, HTRAMER.com. My blog site, and you will get some very helpful information. Thank you. David, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you. Nice to be here.
You had some very unusual experiences as a young teen, working in the music industry, the TV, radio. Tell us a little bit about what happened.
Well, I kind of got jump-started into it because my dad was a TV producer, and he had the first rock and roll TV show that wasn't a dance party. And he wanted to put Top 40 radio on television, which is what he did. And instead of Dick Clark, who would have maybe one act every show and the rest would be playing records and dancing, he'd have like seven or eight acts a show and maybe one dance number. So, you know, he went through a lot of the biggest acts in the world coming through Cleveland to do the TV show. And it started when I was 13, and I'd gone down there, and they needed somebody to hold the cue cards for the host. And my dad said, well, that's a good start for you. And it was. Eventually, I became a co-writer of the show when I was 15 and became an associate producer of the show the following year. So I was really getting my feet wet, learning everything about the TV business and the music business simultaneously, because it was so intertwined with the Upbeat show. And it was through that show that I met a couple of the disc jockeys around Cleveland who encouraged me, because I kept telling them that's what I wanted to do, that I should find a place to start out and get going. And I was working at a clothing store called Man Talk, and they had decided to buy radio time on a station called WXCN from midnight until 6 on Friday and Saturday nights. And I talked them into letting me be the disc jockey on that show, which I became, and learned that business as well. And from there I went to WNCR, which was the first of the progressive rock stations in Cleveland. And then a few of us left there, me and Billy Bass and Martin Perlick, and we went over to WMMS and started that. And, of course, that became a huge monster.
Now, okay, how did this affect your growing up? Do you feel that it gave you a chance to grow up quickly, or do you feel that it put a buffer on you? In other words, I'm the disc jockey. I'm up there. I'm talking to 1,000. Hey, I don't have to grow up. I don't have to do anything I don't want to do. I'm on top. How do you think that affected you?
Oh, I think it had quite an effect on me, not ego-wise, because I didn't realize that that could even be affected at that point.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it was, it's like the old joke, you know, I told my parents, when I grow up, I want to go into show business, and they told me I couldn't do both. You know, I could either go into show business or I could grow up, and I chose to not grow up. And in a way, I guess it was the antithesis. I actually grew up a whole lot faster. You know, when you're all of a sudden dealing with major corporations that own the radio station, you're an adult. And they treat you no different than they would somebody that was in their 30s or 40s or 50s. They figure if you're a professional, then that's how you need to be, and that's how you need to act, and that's kind of what I did. But in my mind, I've always been a whole lot younger than I am. I'm going to be 63 this year, but, you know, I'm 26, 27, 28 in my head, and that works real well for me.
Good age, good age. Now, as you work through your experiences, you no doubt met all kinds of people. I'm not putting down the record business. I have no basis to do that. But commerce isn't always pretty, no matter what that commerce is. Did you find out things? Did you ever sit there and think, hey, I don't need to know this. I'm only 18. I don't need to know people can be that way. I don't need to see this backbiting, or I don't need to see this drug problem or whatever it is.
Well, you know, we were in a brand new industry. FM radio didn't really exist to many people when I first started. In fact, you had to buy a converter to put into your car, or you had to have one of the big old radios that actually got AM and FM. FM just wasn't listened to at the time. So, it was in its infancy, and we didn't really see a lot of the backbiting and stuff because there was no one else doing it but us.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I couldn't believe that I was actually getting paid to play records on the radio.
Mm-hmm.
And getting, you know, every free album I wanted and getting free T-shirts and, you know, all the other pluses that went with it. You know, the women hanging around the radio station and, you know, pretty easy access to pot and alcohol, even though I was underage. You know, it was a pretty good situation for me.
Are there things you found out that you thought really inspired you? In other words, for a lot of people, when you're 15, 16, 17, 18, you go away to college, you see a broader world, and, wow, I don't necessarily like what I'm seeing. Are there things you saw that gave you the exact opposite reaction that really inspired you?
Yeah, you know, when I was like 14 years old, you know, I remember meeting the Beatles for the first time and seeing that these were people that were on top of the world, and you know, yet they took the time to talk to me.
Mm.
And, you know, there were guys along the way that came in to do the TV show or that were guests on my radio show that, you know, all of a sudden I realized that age didn't really matter because I was being treated as an equal because of the work that I was doing.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember the first time that the Hollies came to Cleveland, did the TV show. Graham Nash was there, and I was a huge Hollies fan, and I couldn't believe that I'm sitting here talking to this guy. And he told me a story of when he was like my age of being in London, and the Everly Brothers were playing there, and they chased the Everly Brothers down to the hotel that they were staying at after the show. They, you know, were walking behind them as fast as they could, and the Everly Brothers like invited them up to their room and played them stuff that they were working on and really appreciated that they were fans and all that. And, you know, Graham Nash said, he never forgot that. And no matter what, that's what he was going to continue to be like for, you know, the rest of his life, is be a fan no matter how big he got musically. And he was very successful in that, and continues to be successful in that. And I look at it the same way, you know, as I left the radio world and started managing artists back in the early 70s. Joe Walsh had been a good friend and was hanging out with me at the radio station a lot. And he introduced me to Michael Stanley and told Michael I was going to be his manager. And I told Joe, you know, I don't know what to do in that respect. And he said, well, of course you don't, but you're going to learn. And he brought me out and had a guy named Irving Azoff mentor me. And, you know, Irving's one of probably the most powerful person in the entertainment world right now. So, you know, I knew to make the most of my opportunities. And,
mm-hmm.
You know, at the same time, I'd been dealing with artists that treated me with respect because, you know, here I was on the radio playing their music, which, of course, they needed. And then as I became a manager and worked with other artists, because I had already, you know, done a little bit of it, they just figured I belong there. So that was, I didn't really have the giant, you know, big walls to climb over. You know, they just
mm-hmm.
kind of opened themselves up. I don't know why. To this day, you know, I wonder why Joe thought I could be his manager, and which I was for a dozen years, or, you know, why Cat Stevens wanted me to be his manager, or Dickie Betts, or Richie Fiore, or Al Jardine from the Beach Boys, why any of these guys thought I was the guy. I mean, I'm honored and privileged to work with these guys. So I figure, you know, I work hard, and I think I have the right goals, and it just seems to work.
They sound very vulnerable, what you're describing.
They are. You know, they're artists, and as a result, they spend a lot of time really looking into themselves and looking into others, and they're very childlike in their own ways. And you know, part of being a manager is being a babysitter too, and it's you know, it gets kind of trying in that regard. I remember at one point when I was working with Joe, he had just broken up with Stevie Nicks from Fleetwood Mac, and like for weeks on end, in the middle of the night, I'd get these pleading calls from Stevie to call Joe for her and give Joe this message, and she would send me faxes that she wanted me to read to him, and it was like, you know, it was like they were 12 years old, you know. Joe won't answer his phone.
Oh, good heavens. What you're saying sounds very endearing.
It is, in a lot of ways, and I love the people I work with. And, you know, I've always had the attitude that if I can't wear the T-shirt, I can't work with the artist. And, you know, it's I've turned down a lot of people that I probably could have made a lot more money with, but, it wasn't music that I understood or wanted to be around.
Uh-huh. But we're kind of sashaying around another part of this, which really can't be avoided when you talk about aging and aging before your time. This sounds endearing, the childlike, but you talk about 26. I'm sure you know what the class of 27 is.
No. Oh, yes, of course. What am I doing? Of course I know.
No.
Jimmy
Janice and Jim
all those
Hendrick,
guys. Yeah, right.
And Jim Morrison and Kurt Cobain.
Yeah, they all died. You know, it's interesting that isn't the age I chose.
They were maybe very young in some ways. I mean, Janis Joplin certainly, if you look at her, had a real vulnerability to her.
Yeah,
and a great need to be accepted. I mean,
yeah,
she was
she
up there
no
and she
confidence.
Went back to her high school reunion in Texas. Now, I'm not knocking Texas, but she has to have known it wasn't going well for her when she was there. Not going to go well when she goes back. That
right.
There's a real vulnerability.
Well, and they all were in different ways. Older beyond their years as well. And,
physically,
you know,
I'm sure.
But living a childlike existence. I had an artist recently that called me and was in an airport and didn't know where they were, you know, how do I get to the hotel? I don't even know where I'm staying. You know, because lost the page that the tour manager gave him. I used to get calls back, it was obviously before 9/11, but Joe Walsh would go to an airport and walk up to the counter and say, you know, I want to go to Chicago. And they'd say, do you have a credit card? And he'd say, well, call David. He'll give you the information. And they're like, David who? And he'd put my card down and have them call me to get the credit card information to buy him an airplane ticket.
But when I hear that, I mean, it's fascinating to me. It's amazing. But when I hear that, again, this extreme vulnerability comes up.
Sure.
You got their credit card information. My goodness, I'm not saying you're going to do that, but the wrong kind of person can get in their trust and buy who the blank knows what credit card information.
Oh, and I got to tell you, it probably happens quite a lot. I mean, there's a lot of artists that have been kind of soaked for everything. And, you know, one of the things my dad taught me early on, because he had managed artists also at one point, he said, you know, just never touch their money and they can never question you.
Oh, no way. In this day and age, are you kidding me? Credit card information?
Yeah.
No.
So, I mean, you know, credit. I mean, obviously, if they look at a credit card, they're going to see charges and they're going to know they're not theirs. But I'm talking about, you know, they get paid in cash a lot, and they don't always know how much they're getting paid that night or whatever, and
I
refuse to touch the money.
Well, of course they're going to know it's not theirs, but knowing it's not theirs and being able to deal with it are two different things.
Sure, exactly. Exactly. Yeah, it's an interesting business. I'm not sure what I would have been doing if I hadn't found it.
Sounds fascinating. Just what you're saying, the tension between being a very talented adult and called David.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But it goes on to this day, you know.
I'm sure. Now, there's another angle to this. We've talked about you feeling you're 26. We've talked about class of 27. You get individuals I'm sure you've met, Mr. McCartney, Mr. Starr, Mr. Starkey, whichever.
Yep.
Mr. Jagger, all in their 70s.
Yeah, well, of the clients that I have right now, Dickie Betts from the Allman Brothers, he just turned 70.
Mm-hmm.
Richie Fure from Buffalo Springfield and Poco, he turned 70 in April.
Mm-hmm.
Al Jardine from the Beach Boys, he's 72.
Oh, yeah.
And you know what's interesting? We're talking about things that are 3, 4, 5 years in the future.
I mean,
just like we did 10 years ago.
Very different view of aging. I mean, many people, 70, I'm old, I can't get up, and they're jumping around the place like you would not believe.
Of course.
That
you know, a couple
a
years
very
ago.
Very different view of aging.
Yeah. A couple years ago, a few of the high schools around from where I went to high school, they had a big party for everybody who turned 60 that year.
Mm-hmm.
And I was one of those people. And I went to this party. And I realized that it was broken down into two factions. One were the people who were nowhere near 60 in their minds, and the rest were closer to 70 in their minds than 60.
Mm-hmm,
and around 8:30 at night, you know, a whole bunch of people, they're like, well, they got to get going. It's late. You know, and everybody else is like, are you kidding? We're just getting started.
And for yourself,
but it was amazing to see how old some of these people were that were the exact same age.
Oh, no, it's not amazing. It wouldn't surprise me at all.
I mean, just in looks and attitude, everything.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. You say you'd be 63 this year.
Yeah.
That's, for some people, retirement age, past retirement age.
Right.
And if they're figuring 3, 4 years in the future, so are you.
Right.
So
yeah,
it would seem that this has really kept you very young.
Yeah, I don't know that I could. Boy, retirement just doesn't even seem like an option. I don't know what I would do with myself. You know, it's sitting on a beach somewhere can only last so long.
Yeah, well, I guess so. Now, if we're talking about aging, my personal thought is that young people coming up, who are now, in fact, about 26, 27, 28, whatever, right around in there, fairly recent college graduates, young people are having to grow up faster than did our generation. They
absolutely
are having much thrust on them, much.
At 13, 14, 15, that's already being thrust on them.
Oh, yeah.
I look at some of these kids, and, you know, they seem, you know, they're in their 20s, and they're like 14.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's kind of scary. Even though I say, you know, when I was that young, I was growing up, I guess grown up wasn't the real word. I was just professional.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was the difference. I became a professional very early. So I think at that point you cease having an age.
Mm-hmm.
When people respect you for your talents,
that's just what you do. Age doesn't matter.
You cease having an age, yeah.
But don't you think that young people are forced into a lot more financial concerns?
Oh, absolutely.
And worldly concerns than we baby boomers ever were?
Yeah, you know, I read somewhere that this is going to the now generation is the first generation that isn't going to do as well as the previous generation.
Oh, not. Mm-mm.
And I thought, you know, wow, that's kind of sad. You know,
mm-hmm.
that in my lifetime, every generation has outdone the last one. In every way, whether it was the arts or whether it was technology or whatever. And, you know, for the first time, you know, it looks like status quo would be a positive.
Mm-hmm. Well, the leaps that you have to make into a middle-class job are much higher than previous generations have had to make.
Oh, sure, sure.
I mean, academically, on all levels, I think much higher, much higher.
You know, well, but kids that are coming out of college now are, assistant manager at McDonald's. Because that's
lucky.
All they can get.
If they're lucky.
Yeah. And they're back living in their parents' house, and, you know, it's, I don't know, it's kind of sad in so many different ways.
Mm-hmm. How do you see, you say you're a manager. All right.
Right.
You say you've been a manager, music business, 40 years.
Yep.
Totally different business than what you came into. Totally different. Could you just describe some ways in which it is?
Well, you know, one of the things is that the business, fortunate for me, is the business has grown as I've grown.
Mm-hmm.
Because it really was like the, you know, late 60s, early 70s that the record business and music business that we know now existed.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the key word to that whole thing is music business.
Mm-hmm.
Music was everything. At one point, the business was secondary. Today, it's exactly the opposite. Business comes first before anything happens.
Oh, definitely. Definitely.
So, you know, that's kind of the biggest change that's gone on. You know, in the old days, write that up. We know what we're going to do. You know, I'll show up on your record, you show up on mine, no problem. Now, you know, it's got to go through, you know, 2 weeks of lawyers before we can even approve something like that.
And the ultimate example, of course, is Sgt. Pepper's. This was very experimental.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
No way.
But it was the result. It was the result of, the Beach Boys doing Pet Sounds.
Sure.
And, McCartney talks about that frequently, that when he heard Pet Sounds, he was like, whoa, we've got some work to do.
Nowadays,
and, you know, today I don't think that there's that, it's a competitive business, but I don't think there's, like, direct competition like that. Well, it's like, where it's like, you know, you've got the two biggest bands at the time, you know, Beach Boys and Beatles duking it out hit for hit, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Now it's so, the music scene is so diverse, and there's so many different ways to get music, and there's so many different ways to find out about music that we didn't have, you know, in the early part of what we do now. In one respect, it's very, very good because you have so many more options to be successful.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, because it's so broad, your success isn't going to be anywhere near as big as what success used to be.
Oh, no way. No way. I mean, I think what people forget, for example, with the Beatles, is they were, I won't say disdained, they were resented, misunderstood, whatever word you want to use, every bit as much as they were just emulated.
Sure.
You're just not going to get that now.
Yeah, it went both ways for sure.
You're not going to get
that
now.
And an interesting thing, you know, back with, you know, those days of, the early days of the Beatles, if you look at what they looked like when they first started,
mm-hmm.
where everybody thought they had such long hair and everything, it's like, are you kidding?
It's ridiculous.
Their hair wasn't long at all. It just was over their
totally
forehead.
Ridiculous.
That was about it, you know.
None wasn't even long in the back.
No. And they, people started to respect what they were doing pretty quick.
Mm-hmm.
And, that's what made
or
it
disrespect.
All. Yeah. But then, you know, they had to overcome certain things, like John Lennon saying that they were more famous than Jesus Christ, which it wasn't a wrong statement, fact-wise. They probably were at that point.
Mm-hmm.
But, a lot of the world wasn't ready to hear a statement like that, especially from, you know, a guy in a rock band.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally different.
David, Billy Graham could have made that statement, and everybody would have just nodded and said, wow, that's something to think about.
I cannot see any artist now making a statement pertaining to religion and just sending people off to that degree. I just, I can't imagine it.
Mm-mm. A lot of it is that you know, nobody takes it that serious anymore.
Oh, no.
They just know these guys are, okay, these guys are, you know, they're musicians. Why should we listen to what they say?
Or they're entertainers. They're
right.
There to make a lot of noise and supposedly shock.
There's people that are out there just, I mean, you look at Alice Cooper, you know, when he first came out with, you know, painting his face and having snakes and doing these weird shows. And in the meantime, you know, in his real life, he's a minister and a scratch golfer and a wonderful human being that raises millions of dollars for all kinds of causes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Then he goes out on stage, he's Alice Cooper.
Mm-hmm.
Still doing the same thing, you know.
It's an amazing tension, as we've been saying, of being almost childlike and being just so aware of what you're doing that it is almost like beyond being an adult.
It's a
fascinating tension.
And the interesting part with a bunch of these guys, too, is they have no idea, you know, how highly other people think of them. You know, when we first did the Hell Freezes Over tour with the Eagles,
mm-hmm.
I think we only booked about 12 dates. And the reason was they were all pretty sure nobody was going to show up since they hadn't been around for 13 years.
Wow. Again, the vulnerability.
Yeah, it's right there.
Again. David, thank you very, very much for being a guest on the show.
No problem. It was wonderful talking to you. I hope I opened your eyes a little to what we do on this end.
You did indeed. Thank you very much.
All right. Bye-bye.